B. Collins.
Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Thursday, July 6th, 2017. My Governor Moonbeam, California's Jerry Brown, is going to announce tonight that he'll be hosting a climate conference in San Francisco in September of 2018, just a few months before he retires from his second tour of duty as governor. Now, this is interesting, and I applaud Jerry Brown as an environmental evangelist. He recently went to China. Shortly after Trump had announced we're pulling out of the Paris Climate Agreement. And, on the face of it, he champions important initiatives to deal with our carbon emissions, notably cap and trade. But as we'll explain, Jerry Brown is always a complicated, a controversial figure, and a guy who is quite unpredictable. So this climate summit is scheduled for September of 2018. He is announcing this via a satellite conference call to Hamburg, Germany, where he is shadowing the traveling Trump machine. And he will tell people, we're told via an official leak of the text, look, it's up to you and it's up to me and tens of millions of other people to get it together to roll back the forces of carbonization and join together to combat the existential threat of climate change. He will invite entrepreneurs, singers, musicians, mathematicians, professors, and others to come to San Francisco, and you can wear some flowers in your hair, if there's still flowers on the planet. And what's interesting is that Jerry Brown and his predecessor, Arnold Schwarzenegger, who only has three achievements that he can talk about, one was AB 32, the climate change law. The other two related to congressional redistricting by an independent commission and a change in the primary process called the top two. Other than that, Arnold Schwarzenegger was a total failure as governor. But the state Supreme Court, by declining to review a lower court and appeals court decision, turned down an appeal by state business interests to overturn the existing cap-and-trade scheme that was started by Schwarzenegger. And fundamentally, the court found that this is not a tax. It's more like a permit. They said that the auction system for cap and trade lacks the compulsory features of a tax because businesses have a choice of either buying an allowance or cutting their emissions. It is not accurate, said the court, to liken the auction system to payment for the privilege to stay in business in California. It is a payment for the privilege to pollute the air in California. Now, I agree with that. Here's where things get a little messy, because Jerry Brown is he's facing term limits next year, and he has been pressing the Democratic-controlled legislature to extend the cap-and-trade program. It expires in 2020, but he wants to extend it until 2030. Sounds good, right? But according to a fascinating article by Kate Aronoff, In These Times is the publication, and I can't recall which listener sent this to me, but you know who you are, and thank you. Because it's a fascinating look at the efforts to build on AB 32, the Schwarzenegger law that included cap and trade, or it appears that Brown may be negotiating with oil and gas industry officials to create some sort of a different plan. So In These Times, and in this article, gives you a lot of good history, because Jerry Brown is the son of former California Governor Pat Brown. And after Pat Brown left office, he helped Indonesia's military junta secure $12 million in loans from American banks in the late 60s, and they nationalized the Shell projects and properties in that country. And Pat Brown was awarded control of a regime-linked California oil trading company, as well as half ownership of another oil trading office in Hong Kong. Jerry Brown never talks about this publicly. He has never been forced to disclose his family finances and what he has inherited from his dad, the other Governor Brown. His sister Kathleen, who failed in an effort to run for governor back in the 90s, became a Goldman Sachs exec. She worked for Bank of America, and now she serves on the board of directors for Sempra Energy, one of the state's largest providers of natural gas. Now, that doesn't really prove anything. But when you look at actions, they often really tell us what's going on. So the article gives great detail on the efforts by members of the legislature to craft a new cap-and-trade bill that doesn't repeal any of the existing rules, but is intended to make it more practical, more workable. And it's fair to say that sometimes when the state holds an auction, nobody shows up, and they haven't met their quotas in recent years to really make this system work. So it does need some tweaking, and SB 775 is the favorite approach of the environmentalists because, well, they've actually been included in the drafting of it. And there are details about what the terms of that are that you can read in the article. But Jerry Brown has been found to be meeting with oil industry executives while he's not meeting with the environmental community. And there's some mystery about the visits to the governor's office in Sacramento by people from the oil and gas industries. But again, the environmentalists have not been invited. And the article concludes that the future here remains uncertain, and the future of 775 could dwindle or decline if Brown puts his own bill forward. So we will wait and see. But it's also important to note that Jerry Brown, while he does talk tough on climate change and carbon emissions, he has blocked efforts to restrict fracking on the local level in California. He has refused to ban fracking. He has made only nominal efforts to try to clean up the process and the wastewater that it produces. And in an op-ed in today's San Francisco Chronicle, Liza Tucker from ConsumerWatchdog.org raises questions about Brown's recent high-profile trip to Beijing, which I referenced earlier, because he took 29 other people with him. A delegation of business leaders, including AES, a major builder of fossil fuel power plants in California, and NRG, another builder of electrical generation plants using natural gas. And they were on the flight with him, they attended the meetings with him, and of course, we don't know exactly what was discussed or what role they played. Now, it is fair to say that natural gas is less pernicious than coal-fired plants. We don't have any coal plants in California. They do have them in China. So, as some sort of a transitional approach, natural gas may make some sense. And so I don't take necessarily the darkest interpretation of this. But you could. And it makes Jerry Brown appear to be a hypocritical environmental evangelist. And I'm sorry to say that. I've known Jerry for over 25 years, and I've got a lot of respect for him. But this is one of those issues where I find him puzzling. The tweeter-in-chief was in Warsaw earlier today, the first stop of his European junket. He gave a press conference with the right-wing president of Poland, Andrzej Duda. Didn't mention Duda's crackdown on the press there, or other freedoms that have been restricted under his conservative government. And the interesting parts are, he did attack Russia. In his speech after the press conference, he urged Russia to stop its destabilizing activities and its support for hostile regimes, including Iran and Syria, delivering a broadside on the eve of his meeting with Putin. And he said Poland had agreed to buy Patriot missiles, the missile defense system that is pretty much bogus based on our deployment of it in various theaters over the last 20 years. And he also finally did pledge to honor the terms of NATO, the Mutual Defense Pact, and he praised Warsaw for being one of the few nations that pays its agreed-upon share of NATO. And, of course, NATO is popular in Warsaw. It's not very popular in Moscow. And in the meeting tomorrow with Putin, it's going to be very interesting to see if Trump is as tough as he talked today. And in the press conference, He was asked by an American reporter point blank, do you believe that Russia interfered with the elections? And he danced around it again, saying, they may have, and maybe other people did too, but it's Obama's fault. Yeah, yeah, that's it. It's Obama's fault. And so he is in this irrational, incoherent pose, saying, well, you know, I don't think Russia really manipulated the outcome of our election in my favor, but if they did, it's Obama's fault. And so he speaks out of both sides of that mouth with a forked tongue, whatever other metaphor you wish to employ. And as you know, I am awaiting proof of any of this stuff. And a lot of it is a waste of time and energy. But it'll be interesting to see how he deals with Trump and if the issue of the alleged election meddling comes up. Here's an issue that should be on their agenda, and it comes as a bit of a surprise to me. Vice News is reporting that they're able to confirm, based on recent comments and kind of sleight-of-hand remarks, that the U.S. believes that Russia is arming Taliban fighters in Afghanistan. Now, as you know, this is our whatever war. And Trump recently said, it's hands off. The Pentagon decides how many troops are deployed. And General Mattis, the defense secretary, said, okay, 4,000 more. So we're now up to about 12,000 troops if they've all arrived in Afghanistan. But while Mattis was there in April, General John Nicholson told journalists that he was not refuting reports that Russia was directly supplying arms to the Taliban. And that came after a U.S. official who leaked anonymously told AP journalists in April that Russian-supplied machine guns were being used to attack Afghan security forces in southern provinces, including Helmand and Kandahar. And, of course, Russia had its own run in Afghanistan, the graveyard of empires, and now it appears that they are dabbling once again. There are reported sightings of undercover Russian generals who are offering advice to the Taliban fighters that they're arming. And according to Vice, engaging with the terrorist group could be a ploy to unnerve a bigger enemy. Russia's support for the Taliban is part of a broader game with the United States seeking out conflict where the U.S. hand is relatively weak and Russia can establish a deciding role on the cheap. This is a comment from Michael Kaufman at the Center for Naval Analysis. He goes on, Afghanistan represents the opportunity to become a player in a conflict of some import to the United States. Russian engagement with the Taliban is de facto a vote of no confidence in the U.S.-led effort and the ability of the current Afghan government to retain control. Every day I pause for a second and thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. People like the amazing Faith Peoples. Then there's Casita Kojo Amenya, Andrew Bodo, Paul Elsesser. They're there for me, and I'd like you to have my back too. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. Just takes a couple of minutes. Click on Menu, pull it down, click on Become a Subscriber. Then you're at the sign-up page where you're faced with easy options. $5, $10, $20 a month, our $50 annual subscription. Don't forget, we've got the Apple app in the App Store for iPad and iPhones, and that's just $2.99. So there are a lot of ways you can help out, and I hope you will choose one. If you take the $50 annual subscription and give me a mailing address in the U.S., I will send you a bonus book. And I've got new copies of John Kiriakou and Joe Hickman's book about Abu Zubaydah available as bonus books. The next few items relate to an in-depth interview that I'm releasing to subscribers today. My guest is Corey Dolgan, who is a sociology professor and the author of a new book called Kill It to Save It. And in that discussion, we talk about the so-called voter fraud that enables voter suppression. We talked about the privatization of public education. And we talked about Naomi Klein. And they're all making news today. In this excerpt from my conversation with Corey Dolgan, he talks about Congressman Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House, his recent remarks that poverty is a choice.
That's been part and parcel of the narrative, certainly since Reagan, and that is this kind of hyper-individualism. And the kill it to save it framework that I write about looks at this hyper-individualism and what I consider a kind of corporate ideology that has really become the baseline of an ideological instinct in this country. And so, for instance, that language of choice really rings true to Americans, in part because it has to do with what they, the power they have as consumers or the power they have as individuals to make a choice. And then this notion that somehow the corporate ideology, the corporate sector, handles all of these things so much more effectively and efficiently that if people just leave corporations alone, we now call them job creators, they will in fact give us the opportunities as individuals to make the right choices, and that will lead to our success. And of course, the problems with that logic are legion. The idea somehow that people choose to be poor or they've made bad choices, on the one hand, disregards the incredibly poor choices that rich people make day in and day out, yet seem to have a cushion. Someone like George Bush, I often like to use in my class as an example of someone who pretty much failed at everything he did, had a terrible substance abuse problem. Yet up until the age of 30 or 35, he floated on the fact that he came from one of the most wealthiest and powerful families in the country. And then suddenly, within 10 years, 15 years, was the president of the United States. So one can make very bad choices if one has wealth and power in this country.
The effort to ferret out the non-existent voter fraud by Chris Kobach with Mike Pence at the helm is drawing some appropriate analysis. Stephen Rosenfeld at Alternet notes that this is unabashed voting suppression, that Chris Kobach is a white nativist who is driven, almost obsessed, with the idea of limiting participation in our elections, particularly by people who don't support his right-wing agenda. And Rosenfeld notes that the Kobach effort to collect all the voter files from various states, which is being met with some public resistance. But as I pointed out yesterday, Greg Palast says that, well, 28 of these states have already coughed up their data to the interstate cross-check process. So this is an interesting examination of the whole voter manipulation issue. And it proves you don't have to blame Russians. We got plenty of suspects right here in the good old U.S. of A. Another topic I talked with Corey Dolgan about is the privatization via charter schools and for-profit universities. And we talk about Betsy DeVos, the woman who bought the chair of Secretary of Education by contributing millions to Trump and Republicans. And she has been sued by 18 states and the District of Columbia because, as Secretary of Education, she is delaying the implementation of Obama-era rules to protect the students at for-profit universities, many of whom have gotten ripped off. They take out big student loans, and then the job category that they've trained for doesn't have any opportunities for them. And there are many other schemes and games that are played by these for-profit education, higher education outlets. And this is a really dangerous step from the point of view of people who want an education and don't want to pay for it for the rest of their entire lives. Naomi Klein has a piece in The Guardian today. It's 8 or 10 pages, and it's a fascinating look about how the shock doctrine is coming home here in the United States. She writes, shock tactics follow a clear pattern. You wait for a crisis, or maybe you help create one. You declare a moment of what is sometimes called extraordinary politics. You suspend some or all democratic norms, and then you ram the corporate wish list through as quickly as possible. Doesn't that sound like the Trump wrecking crew and the Republican Congress? And one of the first examples she cites is the increasing fortunes of the for-profit private prison companies, CoreCivic, which used to call itself Corrections Corporation of America, and the Geo Group, saw their stock prices go up by 140% in the case of CoreCivic and a mere 98% in the case of the Geo Group. And they are there to profiteer as the police state expands and our civil rights are squeezed. A great piece by Trevor Aronson, who's been a guest on this podcast many times. He's at The Intercept reporting on a paid FBI informant who continued his life of crime while he was on the federal payroll setting up people for phony domestic terrorism cases. The agent or the informant in question is named Muhammad Agbaria, and he first cozied up to a group in West Palm Beach, including Greg Hubbard. Hubbard told Agbaria, "Hey, I want to go to Syria and fight with ISIS." And so they arranged a trip, and when they got to the airport, everybody got busted except Agbaria. And now, despite the fact that the government did not come clean about the work of this paid informant in setting up these criminals, two of whom, I'm sorry, these alleged domestic terrorism perpetrators, that's the right term, two of them have already pled guilty. This guy Hubbard is going to trial, and the government has not come clean on Agbaria and how he set these guys up and his own criminal past and the fact that he continued scamming people for wire fraud while he was a paid FBI informant. It reminds you of Whitey Bulger, the mobster from Boston who continued to murder people while he was an FBI informant. So Agbaria has this trial coming up with Hubbard, and the government is saying that they may reveal closer to trial date more information about this guy Agbaria. But Aronson notes there are still 15,000 paid informants on the streets of the United States, and an FBI report in 2011 disclosed that agents permitted informants to break the law 5,658 times in a single year. Now, some of that lawbreaking occurs in the pursuit of the surveillance and the framing of these faux domestic terrorism perpetrators. But sometimes they're just continuing their own life of crime. It's amazing. The Bible thumpers at Hobby Lobby, they're the ones who overturned the contraception portion of Obamacare, taking it all the way to the Supreme Court because, as a corporation, their religious values were impaired, were infringed upon. Well, Hobby Lobby has just agreed to pay a $3 million fine and forfeit thousands of smuggled ancient Iraqi artifacts that the U.S. government says were intentionally mislabeled. That's just heavenly deception, though, because these were relics and antique items related to the cradle of Christianity. And so it's okay for a Bible thumper to grab them in violation of Iraqi law, and it's okay to lie about where they came from in violation of American law. And that's what they did. Praise the Lord. And pass the Bible, will you? The chief enforcer of ethics, whose name is Walter Schaub, Jr., director of the Office of Government Ethics, his term isn't up till January, but he's decided to bail because he got a job at a nonprofit, and he has submitted his resignation. That will quiet the, you know, kerfuffles that pop up from time to time, as Schaub would challenge the ethically... how can we describe it? I mean, Trump just bulldozes ethics. He doesn't believe they apply to him. His hotel is a walking conflict of interest down the street from the White House. And the fact that he continues to own the Trump Organization while he pretends his kids are running it and that he doesn't profit from it is just bullshit. So it's sad to see this guy go. He wasn't terribly effective, but he was entertaining, and he did raise a lot of important issues. And I can imagine that Barron Trump, even though he's only 10 or 11, he may be the Donald's choice to take over for Schaub at the ethics office. Because, you know, you can count on a family member. And finally today, I want to recommend a piece in the New York Times. Many lefties have vilified the hiring of a conservative named Brett Stevens. And I've read his columns, and some of them annoy me, and some of them are just okay. But this one delighted me today because it is a right-winger attacking other right-wingers. And in particular, Brett Stevens' target is Sean Hannity, who, it has been announced, will be receiving the William F. Buckley Jr. Award for Media Excellence later this year, and this is being bestowed by the Media Research Center. And Stevens says that, as honors go, neither the award nor the organization are particularly noteworthy. But he goes on a rant about how conservatism was once based on the intellectual power of William F. Buckley Jr. And if you're too young to have known about Bill Buckley, look him up. He was this snarky, condescending, super intellectual, effete snob who used to have a very entertaining TV show. And he'd bring on people who disagreed with him and, you know, chew them up in his own intellectual way. And Bill Buckley lived until about 2008, I think. And in March 2000, he wrote about Donald Trump, calling him a narcissist and demagogue. When he looks at a glass, he is mesmerized by its reflection. The resistance to a corrupting demagogy, he said, should take first priority for Americans. So Buckley is gone, and to have his name linked to Sean Hannity and his anti-intellectual partisan rants is insulting even to Brett Stevens. And he started the column by talking about a Warren Buffett line about three I's, innovators, imitators, and idiots. And he closes by saying, "We reach the idiot stage of the conservative cycle in which a Buckley Award for Sean Hannity suggests nothing ironic, much less Orwellian, to those bestowing it, applauding it, or even shrugging it off. The award itself is trivial, but it's a fresh reminder of who now holds the commanding heights of conservative life and what it is they think." Thanks for joining me today for my News and Comment podcast. We do it every day, 10 stories, about a half an hour, and it's always free. And when I remember to click a few times, it's available on YouTube. Tell your friends, will you? I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.